Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting granular. We've got this stack of community profiles, some pretty technical medical reports, detailed local history.
Yeah, really specific stuff.
Exactly. And the idea is when you stitch these kinds of local sources together, you get more than just news updates. You start to see the blueprint, you know, how a place actually works.
Mm-hmm. It's about understanding that local strength, isn't it? You dig into these maybe slightly less flashy reports, and you find incredible expertise, like the engineering talent, world-class surgery happening locally, or even the economic impact of something like this new eSpace headquarters.
Right. It's all connected if you look closely enough.
Definitely.
Okay, let's unpack this. So first up, let's talk about the people making things happen, the builders, you could say. We've got the outstanding young local leaders of 2025 list here, the 40 under 40 from the Greater Arlington Chamber in Arlington today.
Mm-hmm.
And what jumped out at me right away wasn't just, like, sales figures. It's the focus on administration, on real civic impact.
That's such a key point.
Yeah.
You see people whose influence just ripples outwards, like Liz Bates at Legacy Financial.
Yeah.
She didn't just do her job. She co-created Dancing with the Arlington Stars.
Right, I saw some.
And you get this. In 2 years, that event generated over $550,000 for, what, 32 local nonprofits?
Half a million.
Yeah, huge numbers.
Yeah.
But it's more than the money, right? It's the organizational skill to actually pull that off, that kind of community mobilization.
Absolutely. But, you know, when you see that kind of rapid fundraising success, does the source material mention anything about, like, sustainability? Is it all down to a few hyper-driven people?
Well, that's where someone like Kendall Pugh comes in. He's the Director of Business Administration Operations at New Life Fellowship. The source calls his work essential heart work.
Mm-hmm.
But functionally, it's high-level systems building. Mm-hmm. He's 29, overseeing marketing, HR, IT, finance, and over 100 volunteers.
At 29, that's impressive.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it shows that scaling up, making a lasting impact, needs that solid administrative backbone. It's not just about passion. You know, you need the structure.
So leadership here is less about the spotlight and more about, like, building a resilient operating system for the community.
Exactly. And you see that pattern elsewhere, too.
In the business and civic worlds.
Yeah. Look at Navjot Singh, founded Signature and Singh Real Estate Group. But he wasn't an outsider. He was Mr. UTA, Homecoming King. He used those deep local roots, that trust, to build a 55-person brokerage.
Ah, so leveraging existing community ties.
Right. And then there's Associate Judge Danielle Delaney. She didn't just work within the existing system. She secured a federal grant to start the city's first permanent community court.
That's a big deal. The community court model, it recognizes that for indigent defendants, fines often don't solve the underlying problem.
Precisely. It focuses on root causes, health issues, addiction, things like that. It's about changing the system to deliver actual community justice.
So these leaders, together, they're building these scalable systems, philanthropic, administrative, civic.
That's the takeaway. Building efficiency into community efforts.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Okay, changing focus now. We're moving from sort of the civic structure to the structure of the human body. Specifically, some pretty cutting-edge health stuff mentioned in these reports.
Mm-hmm.
Pelvic organ prolapse, or POP. It sounds niche, but the numbers are staggering. It affects nearly 1 in 3 women.
Yeah, it's incredibly common, especially for women who've had children up to half, the sources say.
Yeah.
And the first thing these reports do is tackle a huge misconception.
Which is?
That Kegels can fix it.
Oh, right. Everyone hears about Kegels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they can help with muscle tone, maybe reduce some mild leakage. But once organs have actually prolapsed, dropped down, Kegels aren't going to lift them back up. That's just not how it works physically.
Okay. So the reports use this analogy, right? Like a house with sagging structure.
Yeah, it's a good way to picture it. If the bladder drops and pushes into the vaginal wall, that's a cystocele. Think of it like the ceiling bulging downwards.
Got it.
If the rectum pushes forward into the vagina, that's a rectocele, like the floor is giving way. So the solution isn't just strengthening the muscles around it. It's about repairing that internal support structure.
Right. But when you talk about internal surgery, people immediately think, you know, long recovery, lots of pain, invasive procedures. How does this report address that? Does it sound like medieval?
No, not at all, actually. That's where the tech comes in. The gold standard treatment they detail is called robotic sacral colpopexy.
Okay.
And it uses the Da Vinci surgical system. The key here is the robotic arms allow for movements and precision that are just, frankly, beyond human hands.
So what do they actually do?
The surgeon uses the robot to attach a special surgical mesh. It's soft, flexible to the top of the prolapsed organs, like the vagina or uterus. Then they secure that mesh to the sacrum, your tailbone. It basically creates a durable internal hammock.
Ah, lifting everything back up.
You exactly. Lifting and supporting the organs back into their natural position. Permanently.
And the robotic part means?
Tiny incisions. It's laparoscopic. So much less pain, dramatically faster recovery. The sources say most women go home the same day.
Same day. Wow.
Yeah. And can get back to light activities in days, not weeks.
Right.
Plus, and this is important, if there's related urinary incontinence, they could often repair that during the same operation. One surgery, complete restoration.
That's incredible progress.
It really is. And it's happening locally. They mentioned Dr. Tracy Cannon-Smith, a urologic surgeon with Urology Partners of North Texas, and UPNT, the group she's with. Their surgeons have done over 10,000 robotic procedures collectively.
10,000?
Yeah. That volume, that specialization, that's what leads to better outcomes for patients. Real expertise.
Okay, now shifting gears completely. From that kind of high-tech surgical precision to, well, old-school grit and incredibly high stakes.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about this amazing life story in the source material. Tommy Norris, Medal of Honor recipient.
Norris's story is just, wow. Resilience defined. Eagle Scout, college wrestler, wanted to be a Navy pilot.
Right, but vision issues stop that.
Yeah. Grounded his pilot dream. So what does he do? Pivots. Volunteers for the Navy SEALs. Gets his Trident in 69.
Okay.
Fast forward to 1972. Vietnam. He's training commandos. Then disaster strikes. U.S. planes go down trying to rescue a pilot, Lieutenant Colonel Icile Hambleton.
And the rescue operation that follows, it reads like a movie script.
Pure controlled chaos is the phrase that comes to mind. First, Norris actually rescues another downed pilot, First Lieutenant Mark Clark. Then the focus shifts to Hambleton, who's been evading capture for 10 days by this point.
10 days on the run.
Yeah. So Norris takes just one Vietnamese commando, Nguyen Van Kit, and they disguise themselves as local fishermen.
Fishermen in a war zone? That takes nerve. What did the record say was the riskiest part of that? Just getting down the river.
It seems like the biggest vulnerability was the boat itself, the sampan. They were floating downriver, often in fog, totally exposed if the disguise failed, relied completely on blending in.
And they just floated.
Floated all night. And then Norris called it a stroke of luck. They found Hambleton wounded exactly where intel suggested he might be.
Incredible. But getting out wasn't easy either. Right?
Not at all. They came under heavy enemy fire just as they were nearing the forward base. Norris had to call in air support, use smoke cover to basically shield their final approach to safety.
Just an unbelievable story. And then the twist.
The twist is extraordinary.
Mm.
6 months later, Norris is on another mission, an intelligence gathering op. He's hit, severely wounded in the head, and actually left for dead.
Oh my God.
But fellow SEAL Michael Thornton refused to leave him. He rescued Norris under fire, and Thornton himself received the Medal of Honor for that specific action, saving Norris.
So two Medals of Honor connected by one man's survival.
Exactly. Reciprocal heroism.
And Norris's service didn't even end there.
Nope. Despite losing his left eye, significant brain injury, he fights to recover and gets a waiver to join the FBI in 1979.
An FBI agent with one eye.
And he used it. He said, basically, no one would suspect a one-eyed man could be an officer. He used it to his advantage working undercover. Classic counterintelligent thinking.
From SEAL rescue to FBI undercover work, what a life.
Absolutely. And his story is going to be featured in the National Medal of Honor Museum's Interactive Conversations exhibit coming up in November 2025. A testament to that resilience.
Truly amazing. It really speaks to the kind of core strength in this community's history. Hmm. Okay, finally, let's bring it back home. Let's look at the sort of the skeleton, the foundation of local identity and how it keeps evolving.
It's got deep roots, that's for sure. Geologically, the area is fascinating. Split down the middle, the west side was beach, ancient oceanic beach, 65 million years ago. The east side, shallow, salty sea.
Wow. Beachfront property millions of years ago.
Kind of, yeah. And humans have been here a long, long time. Evidence along the river tributaries goes back at least 7,000 years, maybe even 15,000.
And the city's modern origins are tied up in that 19th century westward expansion, the conflicts.
Right. There was a failed Anglo settlement, Bird's Fort, in 1841. That failure directly led to the Treaty of Bird's Fort in 1843 between the Republic of Texas and several Native American tribes.
And that treaty paved the way.
It facilitated settlement and trade. Led to trading posts, including the one that grew into Johnson Station, a key stagecoach stop, and early Texas Rangers outpost. That treaty, that early decision, really shaped how the area developed.
Okay, fast forward quite a bit to the 21st century. Local identity, now strongly linked to sports, obviously. The sources introduced the new Texas Rangers manager, Skip Schumacher.
Yeah, and his approach seems really structured. He has this leadership philosophy summed up by an acronym, KPE.
KPE.
Communication, alignment, preparation, and execution. It's a systems approach, really. Ties back nicely to those leadership examples we talked about earlier, building effective structures.
Interesting connection. And there was a little detail about his jersey number, 55.
Yeah,
nice piece of local color. He chose 55 to honor Oral Hershiser. The Dodgers, great. Apparently, Hershiser gave him some advice once. In this game, you can believe the people who say you can't, or you can believe the people who say you can.
Huh. Good advice. Sets a tone.
Definitely speaks to the kind of positive, determined culture they want, I think, both for the team and maybe the wider community.
Speaking of culture and community, let's wrap with some holiday traditions. Big local events mentioned here. The Texas Christkindle Market is back.
Right, at Globe Life Field's North Plaza. Runs late November through December 23rd. And it's a pretty big deal culturally.
How so?
Well, it's modeled on traditional German Christmas markets. And it's actually one of only 5 official designated Christkindle markets in the whole U.S. free entry, too. They have authentic German imports like Käthe Wohlfahrt ornaments, those Bavarian nuts.
Ah, the real deal.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a big anniversary, the Interlaken Christmas lights display.
Oh, yeah, that's huge.
Celebrating its 50th year. 50 years. Runs December 13th to the 25th. Apparently, they're trying to get almost all 200 homes participating this year for the golden anniversary.
That'll be quite a sight. 50 years of neighborhood lights.
It really paints a picture, doesn't it? Leaders, building systems, cutting-edge medicine, restoring health, deep history informing the present, and these strong civic traditions holding it all together.
So what does this all mean?
I think it really highlights that a community's true strength often lies in that specialized competence, you know, whether it's the surgical skill of Dr. Cannon Smith with that robot, or Kentel Pugh mastering the complexities of nonprofit administration, or even Skip Schumacher implementing a clear strategy like KPP.
Hmm?
Deep expertise combined with local commitment that seems to be where the real impact happens.
Right. The power is in the specifics. Which leads us to a final thought for you, our listener, to kind of mull over. We mentioned near the start that eSpace is setting up its North American headquarters here.
Yeah.
That means potentially over 2,000 high-wage, high-tech jobs, an estimated $8 billion in salaries over 30 years.
A massive economic engine.
Exactly. So think about this. We just talked about how foundational decisions in the 1840s, like the Treaty of Bird's Fort and Johnson Station, shaped the long arc of this community's history. So how might this huge influx from eSpace, the jobs, the money, the type of industry, how might that specifically shape the culture and the demographics of this place over the next 30 years? What will that long arc look like starting now?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? History in the making.